Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be asking whatever became of Google's golden rule, don't be evil, as we meet business journalist and broadcaster Rana Faruha.
Then we'll be discussing why sometimes it feels like all we're doing is pushing a bloody big rock up a hill, only to watch it fall back down again as we sit down with Greco-folk freakout duo Coloris White.
And we'll be hearing from the curator of a major new exhibition of the work of Dora Maar.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news and we'll enjoy some great music too. That's all here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Oh, Org, it's great to be sharing some quality time with you here on a Sunday lunchtime. How's the week that was before we look at the week that will be?
It was fine. How was your week?
It was cold and clear and kind of felt kind of all. Do you know what? I'm beginning to feel Christmassy.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of enjoying that. I'm enjoying some proper cold weather. Get out the proper heavy tweed coat.
Yeah.
Get the hats out. I don't mind it.
I thought you were jingling as you walked into the studio.
Yeah.
Have you done any nice cultural things this week?
Well, I enjoy wandering off and looking at the Dora Maar exhibition and interviewing Lemma Lewis, the curator. As you said in the introduction, we'll be meeting her a little bit later on in the show. It's just a very favourable way to spend a morning. We kind of mostly work in an office, in and out, and all the rest of it. We get to work at home and do our own little projects and things.
Some of us might.
But... Yeah, exactly. The contents of that anecdote may have settled in transit, ladies and gentlemen. But it's always a joy to go and your first date of the day be going to see a film or going to see an art show. So it's really great to go and see the Dora Maar programme. We'll see what we think about that later.
I completely agree with you. That sounds like a lovely week.
Yes, it's been okay.
Crisp
been okay.
And cultural.
Crisp and cultural. Talking of which... I can tell by the shirt he's wearing that he feels both of those things and more. Let's get Fernando in to talk about next week's news. There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. Faye, welcome to the programme.
Hello, always a pleasure on a Sunday.
I just love listening to your voice. Any day of the week, I don't think it feels like a Sunday now unless we have Fernando Augusto Pacheco's august tones on the programme. Well, how are you first, before we get into the nitty-gritty?
You know what? I'm feeling very good. You know, winter is not really my season, you know, but I try my best and I agree with you. It's getting Christmassy. And I like this period between mid-November to Christmas because then at least there's some light in the streets. There's something to do, you know, but yeah, winter is not really my... I don't know how to dress for winter. And you know why I'm also excited, actually? I know, guys, you might laugh at me, but I think elections are quite exciting.
Mm. When it's not your own country.
Oh, yes. I mean, depending on the result, actually, in a way. I mean, but for example, I mean... I decided my first story to be the elections in Uruguay. The runoff is actually today.
See, we're into that massively.
Yeah.
Uruguay, thrilling. Yes, bring it on.
I mean, I'm sure you're
Let
excited.
Let something nuts happen. You know, Luis Suarez is the prime minister. Great.
To be honest, I mean, nothing nuts happening in Uruguay when it comes to politics because they are quite stable, you know, when it comes to Latin America. Mm. But there's an interesting dispute there between the left and the right. I mean, the left has been in power for 15 years. I think they've done a great job. And I think Uruguayans, I mean, they might not win the election, but it's not because Uruguayans are rejecting completely. I think they just want change. Mm-hmm. And the right-wing candidate, like Calle Pou, he's kind of only talking about security and the rise in crime, which is the main topic in Uruguay. Because it's true. I mean, as I said, it's a safe and stable country, but crime has been rising. In fact, I think their homicide rate is higher than Argentina at the moment, which it's something that the Uruguayans are taking very seriously. So I'm quite curious to see. I mean, because Latin America is divided now. We have more or less the same countries to the left and the same to the right.
Polarised politics.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Has it been a nice campaign for everyone? I mean, it sounds a little bit like a kind of...
I like that question. Beatrix Potter question. Has it been a nice election?
It's a great question, Og, because even José Mujica, the former leader of the Frente Ampla, the leftist alliance, he said... You know what? If you go to your opposition, it's okay. We will be, you know, a nice opposition. Maybe Uruguayans want to change. That's so rare to find.
Yeah, imagine that, Rob.
My second story is kind of interesting because I actually have a very busy week ahead because I promised that on Thursday I'll be celebrating Thanksgiving with my American friend, Karen Krizanovic. I never celebrated Thanksgiving before, I have to say. Apparently it's just eating good food and kind of celebrating with friends
it's
in a way.
It's eating okay food and celebrating with friends.
Okay.
No, it's good. I'm going to be doing the same thing. My wife's American, as you know. We're going to be having a bit of a go at that.
As you say, I just came back from Zurich. This Saturday is the Monaco Christmas Market there as well. So I'm not going to be there, but we have a team there going. I think Zurich actually fits Christmas so well. I could see already a lot of Christmas markets in the streets when I was there.
Yeah.
And I love the weather there because it's cold, but it's a bit different from London. It's a bit crispier, you know?
Yeah.
It's something quite special there. And I love raclette. I love roasty. I love those kind of lovely food.
Will Father Christmas from Finland be heading over as per?
I'm sure he will. And then the following week
he's
into
sort of
London.
A fortnightly retainer, isn't he, to Monaco at the moment? Yeah. And then he's coming around here, isn't he?
He will be with his flock of deers.
Don't demean the Christmas myth of Santa Claus.
His old deers.
Yeah, National old celebrations deers. And Christmas.
Faye, that
perfect.
Was a lovely bunch of stories you brought us there. Thank you so much for joining us. As ever, don't go away, listener. We'll be right back in just a sec hearing about how big tech abandoned its principles, if it ever had any, with Rana Faruha. Stay tuned.
The apocalyptic impulses of big tech are something we come back to time and again in this programme. Of course, we are but conduits for the vibrations of the wider world, and so it is that we channel what must surely be one of the great pressing issues of our times.
The litany of outrages to be laid at the feet of the tech giants is too long to get into here. Suffice to say, their behaviour is a far cry from one of Google's inaugural rules: don't be evil.
A strong statement, that, and whilst Google may have abandoned it, it's been picked up elsewhere. It's the name of a new book by writer, broadcaster and Financial Times associate editor Rana Faruha. She's turned her gaze on big tech to ask how we arrived in this mess, why and what we can do.
I sat down with Rana a little earlier and started by asking how the book came about.
I had just started my job at the FT doing commentary, op-ed pieces on the biggest economic and business stories. And so I was thinking a lot about big tech and how much wealth and power it had. But one day I came home around that time and I opened a credit card bill and I started noticing all these tiny charges of $1.99 here, $3 there. And I tallied them all up and it was over $900. And I couldn't think what I had possibly been buying on the App Store. They were all from the App Store. And then I thought, oh, my son, Alex, who's 10, has my password. And so I went downstairs and I remember him sitting on the couch. He was holding his phone, as he almost always is, and it was beeping. He was playing some game and I tried to get his attention and it took me a couple minutes to do that. And I started quizzing him and I said, "What, you know, what is this?" And at first he was sort of, "Oh, I don't know what you're talking about." And then he said, "Oh, that." He had been playing an online soccer game that was supposedly given away for free, but these games draw you in and then they sell you in-app purchases, which is how they make money. I mean, a game like Fortnite, for example, makes 95% of its money on in-app purchases. And the idea is to sort of pull you along the way a casino would, with behavioral nudges and persuasive technologies that keep you playing, keep you clicking, and keep you going where the game company wants you to go. And so as a mother, I was kind of horrified that he'd been spending so much time on this thing that he'd racked up over $900 in charges. But as a business journalist, I thought, wow, this is an amazing model. I need to understand everything about this.
You start the book, you open it up with a quote from Mary Shelley. Obviously, last year was the sort of 200th anniversary of the publication of Frankenstein. But I feel like there's quite a lot of Frankenstein in the air at the moment. It's something that we keep revisiting. I mean, is that fair to say? Does it have these parallels with big tech?
I think it does. I mean, you know, Frankenstein started as a dream to create life, right? And ends up creating a monster. And in some ways, that's the arc that the book is trying to look at. It's this 20-year arc of where were these companies in the mid-1990s? I mean, it was this sort of idyllic time in Silicon Valley. I'm old enough that I was there covering companies. I remember my first trip out to the Valley, it was not to cover Google, but to cover Yahoo, which was at the time the big, you know, ooh, cool company. I remember David Filo walking around in flip-flops in the office. And how did we get from that utopia that was all about these cool new products and these innovators that were going to start in garages and change the world to this complete dystopia that we have today, where you have elections being swung by hate on social media, platforms that are become ways to encourage genocide, kids being completely addicted to technology. You know, one of the things I've been fascinated by just in my own home is my son, particularly relative to my daughter, who's older, doesn't read nearly as much as he might. And actually, it's interesting. There's a lot of research coming up now showing that since about 2011, 2012, reading levels and abilities have been falling off. College professors are now complaining that the first generation of digital natives are coming in and they cannot handle the core curriculum because they simply cannot do 200, 300 pages of reading a week. So if we can't focus, I mean, if our attention is so scattered, how do you solve the biggest problems of the day? How do you even begin to think about things like climate change, populism, the economic paradigm, if you really can't stay focused on more than 280 characters?
You mentioned there the sort of utopian underpinnings of Silicon Valley. And in the book, you refer to figures like Jared Lanier, who obviously represents this kind of much more upbeat vision of what technology could do and what it could be, and who has subsequently become a very outspoken critic of big tech. I wonder, this title, Don't Be Evil, is obviously taken from the, it seems unbelievably cynical now, doesn't it, that it was once, you know, one of Google's core tenets. Do you think with these companies, with Google, with Facebook, were those ideological underpinnings always there? Were they at one time aligned with the Jared Lanier's of the world? Or is that actually, were they misrepresenting themselves?
I think they were, but I think that moment was brief. One of the things I was most fascinated by in my research is going back to the initial paper that Larry and Sergey, the founders of Google, did on search. And it's online. Anyone can look at it. It's from 1998. They did it while they were grad students at Stanford. And it describes what Google would be, how you would run it, and then at the end, how you would monetize it. And there's a section in the appendix that is titled, I believe, Advertising and Its Discontents. And it talks about how if you use highly targeted advertising to fund a search engine like Google, that you're inevitably going to end up with a conflict between the companies or, you know, even the public entities that might want to reach consumers and the users themselves. The interests of the users and the interests of the advertisers may not be the same. And so, in fact, the pair advocates for an academic search engine or some kind of an open system where you could have a nonprofit that would be in the public interest. And it's fascinating because that is exactly where we are today. So they did know from the beginning. But, and I track this in the book, as they got closer and closer to IPO, the venture capitalists were like, where's the business model? And, you know, this is just a business model that can pull in profits like no other business model in history. And P.S., it's becoming everyone's business model. You know, and we talk a lot about the FANG companies and the tech platforms, but Starbucks knows a lot about you. Johnson & Johnson knows a lot about you. You know, healthcare companies, financial companies, everyone is practicing surveillance capitalism today. And it is happening so fast and it is so deep. And that's why I think we need to at least have a clear narrative and a public conversation about it now and decide, what do we want the rules to be? Because otherwise we're going to end up like China in a surveillance state.
So as Mamon started it, as always, these technological developments that have gone sour and this link to Frankenstein, I was just thinking about that. And I was thinking about technological developments that shaped the 20th century, starting with Marinetti's futurism or the vorticists in the UK, you know, these cultural figures who fetishized machinery, fetishized advancement, and whose bubble was burst quite abruptly by the outbreak of the First World War when they witnessed the horrors of industrialized warfare. Then we invented the bomb. Then we transport reshaped cities. The streets were privatized in ways to afford rights to motorists rather than pedestrians. All of these things seem to kind of go wrong at some point. Yeah. Why would tech have ever been any different?
It's a great question. I think what's different perhaps this time is just the depth and breadth of change. So I think about what we're going through as a new industrial revolution. It's a digital revolution. You know, if you think about the industrial revolution, probably took about 70 years to play out altogether. I think we're 20 years in. We're at the end of the consumer stage of this transformation, and we're about to go into the Internet of Things, smart machines, connected, talking to one another. That is going to put what we've been talking about now on steroids. And one interesting case study of this is actually playing out. Google has a project called Sidewalk Labs. It's a smart city that's being built in Toronto. And until quite recently, Toronto just said, sure, Google, come on in and take over 12 acres of waterfront and put sensors wherever you'd like, gather data, look at people 24/7. And the idea, you know, the benign part of this is it's supposed to help traffic patterns, energy consumption, et cetera. And you can imagine that that absolutely would be the case. But the other side is that Google now owns literally everything that happens within this 12-acre radius, and they were the only ones to get access to it. And as the conversation that we're having has been brewing, suddenly, a couple of weeks ago, public officials said, you know what, maybe we'll put this data in a public data bank, and that way taxpayers, citizens can get access to it, can understand what's being done with this data. But also, and this is quite important, smaller companies can also get access, because one of the things that happens is that when a big tech platform comes in and just ring fences huge swaths of data, it creates dark zones where innovators can't go. And so these companies have become kind of the opposite of what they were in the beginning. They were the garage startups. Now they are the giant monopolists that, to my mind, look very much like the 19th century railroad companies.
I'm interested in that because there's a fair amount made of the kind of Randian underpinnings of Silicon Valley and that growth, that drive to expand. You liken it to the railroads. Is that therefore not so new? Does the state always need to intervene in situations like this to break up monopolies? Will businesses always operate according to these principles? Or is this kind of Randian drive, this unfettered quality, is that something more recent?
That's a really interesting question. So I'll take that in two parts. Mm. I do think that capitalism will do what it's allowed to do. And you do see these pendulum swings from private sector power to public sector power and back again. You know, in the last 100 years or so, I would say, you know, you had the rise of the railroad monopolies. Then you had just a clear concentration of power that was degrading the overall economic ecosystem. And then you had a reformer like Louis Brandeis, for example, in the U.S. come in. And then you had it swing back towards public power. Same again in the 1920s. You know, you have a market crash, then you have the New Deal. You had a lot of public power during the wartime periods and the 50s and 60s post-war, kind of more industrial planning in the U.S. And then by the 70s, all right, maybe it was time for the Reagan-Thatcher revolution. Maybe that was appropriate. I think we have reached a pendulum shift now where it is natural and appropriate for the public sector to start taking back some control because concentrations of wealth and inequality are the same that they were in the Gilded Age. However, to go to your point about what's different about the Valley, the Valley is interesting because many people out there claim to be liberal or social liberals, let us say. They would tend to vote Democrat. They're very woke. But really, many of them, I would say, are truly libertarians. I mean, they are hyper-capitalists. And think about the people that run these firms. Many of the Mark Zuckerbergs, the Sheryl Sandbergs, you know, they grew up in an era really from the 1980s onwards where the government was really just for cutting taxes. You know, there was not a public discussion, particularly in the U.S., about what we could do together collectively as a society. That was very much the greed is good era. And so I think they haven't known anything different. And I think in some ways a company like Facebook is the apex of the sort of neoliberal economic ethos that we've all been practicing for the last 40 years.
I'm keen to return to that in just a sec. But before we move too far away from public intervention and the need for it, obviously we've got this election coming up in the UK. The issue is Brexit. I wonder whether we underestimate the role of unions like the EU in acting as a bulwark against big tech, certainly over here.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to be made. You know, the EU is probably where the most interesting model for regulation is going to come from. I mean, you're already seeing Margaret Vestager, who is the toughest cop on these folks, come out and say, hey, you know what? Maybe the burden of proof in issues like competition needs to be on the larger player. That's crucial because, again, these are the new too big to fail firms. They're very similar to the financial sector pre-2008 financial crisis, where there's a black box. Only they know what's happening in that black box. There's no transparency. And so I think pushing some of that back onto the biggest players is appropriate. I think it's going to be very difficult for smaller countries to do that. And I do think actually that we may be moving to kind of a tripolar world in which the U.S. goes one direction with regulation, Europe, the European Union goes another, and then China goes a third direction and takes some of the emerging markets with it into the surveillance state model.
And that's a country where tech and governance are far more integrated.
100%. And it was always thus. I mean, you know, I remember actually going right around the time that the Edward Snowden story broke. I was actually in China and I was interviewing a PLA general, a woman, interestingly. And I was asking her about the complaints about industrial espionage. And she sort of looked at me like, well, why would you ever think there would be a difference between companies and the state? That's just the way it is. And so, of course, now in China, with surveillance capitalism, there is no privacy debate. And some people like Kai-Fu Lee, who came out with a book, he's a big Chinese venture capitalist and actually started Google in China, came out with a book saying China's going to rule the world because now, in the age of AI, it's really all about data. How much data do you have? How much can you plug into the algorithms? If you believe that model, then yeah, maybe China is going to own the future. I personally think that innovation comes from decentralization, not from a top-down approach. But either way, surveillance capitalism has major worrisome impacts for human rights. You look at in China, there's a social credit system now. So what you're doing and saying online is being watched. If you're right thinking, maybe you'll get your mortgage. Maybe you'll get a promotion at work. If you're wrong thinking, you may end up in the gulag. And, you know, all these technologies are being used to repress Muslim minorities in Xinjiang.
Yeah, awful. To return to that underlying very strong vein of libertarianism, which you acknowledge in the book, as you just mentioned now. Facebook has been accused of subverting democracy, but Zuckerberg himself seems far more like a kind of, well, he's practically a cipher, isn't he? He's this sort of avatar of moral flexibility. There are these figures in big tech who are much more viscerally malevolent. I'm thinking of Peter Thiel particularly, yeah, who has some pretty menacing contacts in his book. He has a quite grim worldview. He has an interest in these bizarre projects like seasteading, which seem to be solely so that he can live kind of outside the laws of the land. And he has a track record of acting according to his personal or ideological interests, for example, funding Hulk Hogan's case against Gawker.
Right.
How worried should we be by these very rich and powerful figures starting to act to inform policy in ways that extend beyond just business or their financial interests?
Very worried. And, you know, I have two thoughts on that. First, Palantir, which is one of Thiel's firms, has actually been at the forefront of big data policing. And this was something that was started under the Obama administration, actually, to try and get rid of racism in policing. You know, the idea that if you're African-American or dark-skinned, that you would be maybe targeted. The idea was, let's gather more data, let's make policing more factually based. The problem is that the algorithms are only as good as the humans that are programming them. And so, for example, in LA, the police officers now scrape data from Facebook, they get data from Palantir, they plug it all into a big black box, and you might end up being under surveillance when you have absolutely no criminal record because your data profile simply points the police in your direction. So again, it ends up with a situation, you've started with a good idea, but because there's no transparency and no public accountability, you end up in a worse position than you were to begin with. In terms of Thiel versus Zuckerberg, you know, in a funny way, I find Peter Thiel less nefarious than Mark Zuckerberg because he is who he is. He's quite straight up. You know, he'd like California to break off from the rest of the country. He's got his bunker in New Zealand. We know who he is. Who is Mark Zuckerberg? I mean, as you mentioned, he's this sort of moral cipher. And I think this goes to the point that the heads of these companies, and I would throw Sheryl Sandberg into that pot as well, are much less liberal than they are libertarian. They will talk their own book no matter which political side it falls on. Someone like Eric Schmidt, for example, who's a major figure in American politics, he's supposedly a Democrat, but he gives equally to Democrats and Republicans because it's in his own best interest.
There's a lovely quote in this book: it's much easier to break things than fix them. We've just touched on Zuckerberg's libertarianism, but I wonder on a more fundamental level, you know, I know that you explained this idea of Facebook as the kind of apex of neoliberalism as the result of a generation that's only seen the government give tax cuts and so on. Is there something deeper? Where is this amorality from? Like, where is the social conscience? Is this a response to the sort of vaguely purported idea of millennial nihilism?
Gosh, that's a deep question. I tend to think of it more as an economic construct. It's funny about millennial nihilism and some of the millennial concerns. I mean, in the US, as I think in the UK, there's a lot of discussion about identity politics, a lot of wokeness. But I think there's something deeper below that. And I think even though you hear a lot about race and gender, that the action is really in class. And it's about a feeling, a very correct feeling amongst millennials, that they've been saddled with more debt than ever before in history. They can't afford housing. In the U.S., they come out with $30,000 a year average college debt. They're underemployed and probably will remain so their whole lives. Statistics show when you enter a weak job market, you never actually regain those losses. So I can understand why they're nihilistic. I think that they're squaring off in the what is probably going to be the biggest fight of our age. The boomers and the millennials are squaring off because there's this shrinking public pie and they want their piece of it. And this calls into question capitalism as it has been practiced. Now, we've had a certain kind of Anglo-American neoliberal economic thinking. You can make different choices. I mean, you know, one of the points that I would make, and this is something that the academic Mariana Mazzucato would argue as well, the technologies that drive all this profit, the internet, GPS, touchscreen technology, these are all funded by taxpayers. Most of this stuff came out of the U.S. Defense Department, and yet citizens get none of this incredible wealth hoard. It's beyond anything. You have 80% of profits now living in the 10% of companies that have the most data and IP. Where's our share of them? I mean, we are the natural resources. In countries like Denmark or Israel or Germany, they make different decisions around that wealth sharing. And so to me, that's the deep question, but it's a complicated question. It's much easier to stay in your tribal fight than it is to grapple with the nature of capitalism.
To end on a slightly grim note, I'm afraid, I was thinking about that George Orwell quote, to imagine the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. I wondered if there's an anecdote or a learning, a discovery that you made in the course of researching and writing this book that you think can be used to kind of look at where we're headed, what's coming.
Well, it's interesting. I'll legitimize the negative, but also kind of stress the positive. You know, I think we are at risk of really dehumanizing progress, dehumanizing technology. Technology, by the way, has always been throughout history a net job creator and prosperity giver, but only when education and social progress keeps up with it. And sadly, since the 70s, that link has been broken in the rich world. But I will end, you know, you mentioned Jerome Lanier. I'll end with a more positive note. He and some others are beginning to think about how do we share data wealth? And interestingly, California, which is, of course, home to all these companies and in some place the birthplace of the problem, as well as the progress, they're coming up with some very interesting ways to think about how to turn the tide, at least in terms of the economic impact. So California has proposed a digital dividend where if data is the new oil and it's being mined for free, then some of it should go back into a fund, almost a digital sovereign wealth fund, which would be used for things like pensions and healthcare and education. I think that that's the future. I think data as labor could help rebuild the labor share of the pie. And that's something that we have to do. Otherwise, the growth numbers are just not going to work.
Thanks to Rana Faruha and Don't Be Evil, How Big Tech Betrayed Its Founding Principles and All of Us, is out now. And you are listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Time for some music now. We'll be hearing from Kyloris White in just one sec. They're a duo made up of rhythm section and Cretan lute. Before that, let's hear from another band who've done very well with equivalent austerity. This is Cummins Falls by $75 Bill.
Was Cummins Falls by $75 Bill, and we'll be back with some art in a minute. Do stay tuned.
Kailouris White is the duo made up of Greek singer and Cretan lute player George Kailouris and Australian drummer Jim White. George comes from a musical family renowned for bringing both the ancient folk traditions and contemporary character of his home island, Crete, to the wider world. And Jim is best known as one third of the Australian instrumental outfit Dirty Three, as well as keeping time for artists ranging from Smog to Cat Power and PJ Harvey.
The duo's latest album is called The Sisypheans, named after the Greek myth of King Sisyphus, punished for his craftiness by being sentenced to rolling a heavy boulder up a hill for eternity. It's where the phrase, a Sisyphean task, a thankless job, gets its name, of course. You ever feel like Sisyphus, Org?
Yes, I do, Rob. Monocle's Tom Hall recently went to meet them during soundcheck just before they took to the stage in Walthamstow, East London, and began by asking George about that age-old Sisyphean myth.
The Sisyphean's idea start on Nauatuas. From that story I was telling to Jim about after concerts I play, you know, friends ask me, I would like to be around at your place when you play by yourself to see what you play those times. And I was thinking and I thought what I play is the stuff I play all my life. And one of them is a Protos Chaniotis, which I love. It's a melody of traditional Crete music. I was telling to Jim, and we brought up the Sisyphean myth about the rock carrying up the mountain. I thought my rock is that melody, that Protos Chaniotis. Because every time I play that Proto Chaniotis, I discovered again, over and over again, and then I experimental to the gigs. There were people dancing and to figure out what I've got. And then I keep going, go back home and play it again and again, and I love it. And I never bored because I always discover new stuff. And that's how the myth came on and the idea. So that's the start of Sisyphians.
So the Sisyphean myth, it's about a king rolling a boulder up a hill, up and down forever.
Well, actually, it's like the rock falls down. You know, he carries, it's a curse. He's sentenced to that, I believe. It's not Cretan, it's the mainland, right?
Yes.
So he carries it up and, you know, he's sentenced to this, but actually, you know, I mean, really, I did an interview this morning somewhere else and we did some yesterday. It's Sisyphean. I mean, you know, we turned it into a positive thing. I mean, what else is there? We're not saying it's like Buddhism or something. It's just like actually a musician, that's what they do. They go around, they play music. It has to be fresh to enjoy it and to make it actually good, I think. It has to be like new every time. Just like when you carry the rock. And what isn't? I mean, you know, if you want to be not Sisyphean, it's sort of in our little record's been out a week and in the conversation that's been going on around it, people have turned it to music in particular. I think partly because of the record company frame and something we wrote in terms of musicians. But I mean, it's the same with everything, right? Unless you want, you know, to get more and more money or something. We see it as positive.
If you were going to sort of try and place it in some kind of modern context or some everyday context, are you sort of just using that title as a reference to the fact that people get up and do the same thing every day and you sort of have to exist in it and make it different for yourself every day? Is that something close to what you're getting at?
I mean, yeah, but that's not modern, is it? There's nothing modern about that. I mean, that's just like human. But yeah, I think so. Something can be drudgery or not, you know. Yeah, something along those lines.
And Georgia, so I wanted to talk about the music of Crete. Tell me how it differs from maybe some of the music that you would say find on the mainland in Greece. How does the musical culture in Crete sound different in any way to something you might find coming from Athens, for example?
Each part of Greece has their own instruments, their own music, dance, different sound. Crete has a very lively dances and so moody and a cappella stuff, epic poems and melodies, they're going in a monotonous circle to tell the lyrics, going on and on for a long time. Even in Crete, we have each part of Crete, each place has their own style of the same tune. So there are a lot to find out and play with and see the difference. And that's another reason that makes it Sisyphean. But mostly because it's a lively and moody, atmospheric. The difference is in the sound of instruments too, because we play lira, a lot of lira in Crete music, bow instrument, three strings, and lute, mine instruments, and also bagpipes and percussion.
Do you think you're having different influences there because you're out in the sea there?
Yeah, of course. The landscape, I believe, makes the sound of each area. So, yeah, our landscape is the sea and the mountains same time.
Do you think an island mentality feeds into the personality of the place? Because I know that Greece is made of many thousands of islands and it is a very coastal place, but say the UK, that's an island, and we tend to feel like we think a bit different from, say, mainland Europe, which we are obviously sadly seeing quite a lot of in the news today. But I mean, does an island mentality feed into your mindset and the identity of Crete?
Crete is in the middle of the Aegean Sea. And back in the centuries, you know, had been occupied of different civilization, you know, from Venetian period, from Arab periods, from Ottoman periods, empires. So the music had influenced from this, especially in the coast, but also in the mainland, in the mountains, you know, the music goes back in, more back from that period, you know, before the empires. So they keep that mixture has been mixed and gives more option and more space to the music.
Jim, I mean, you've known Georgios for decades, but before you met him, were you interested at all, or did you know much about sort of Cretan or Greek music? Did you have any sensibility of that?
I grew up in Melbourne, which is the third biggest Greek city in the world after Athens and Thessaloniki. And the area I grew up in was actually largely populated by Greeks. That was the majority of people I grew up. And yet I didn't have any relationship to Greek music, particularly. My mum took me to see Theodorakis when I was a kid, who actually maybe is Cretan origin. So, you know, yes and no to Greeks, yes to the music. And did I know what Crete was specific to Greece or anything? No.
I guess my question there would be, what is it in that music that really spoke to you, I guess? Because it's not the same as, say, whatever, 12-bar rock and roll, of course. I mean, is there anything character-wise in that kind of music where you heard this and you were like, oh, this is something that speaks to me?
Yeah, as much as I do like Status Quo, if that's what you're referring to. But
I also love Status Quo.
I also love Cretan music. And hearing George play in Melbourne and his father on record and later on live, it was very immediate, you know. Like, I think you asked, was it something specific that spoke to me? And the answer is that something spoke to me. That's why I liked it. If it didn't speak to me, then I wouldn't be doing it. What was it? To me, it's just, you know, I'm not a musicologist. I'm not a particularly sophisticated listener. And, you know, over the years now of listening to it, and I listened to it for many, many years, never thinking I would play it. That would be, and, you know, we do our own thing. But however, at one point we were playing at a ATP 33, were playing there, and I was playing there with Smog, and also, and George and his father were playing there, and then Sarandoni asked me to play with them, and I was like quite taken aback, but I did it because he asked, you know, and, you know, I did it with no knowledge sort of that, because I was listening to it for enjoyment. You know, this is very different than what Solaris White do, but, you know, it's part of that story. I would say the answer would be like the things that I like in all music: elemental, energetic, moving, exciting. These things, words that I use for all music I like, and if it's music from down the road and I don't like it, I don't like it, you know what I mean?
Could there ever be room in a Zoloris White set for a Status Quo cover? Like maybe Caroline, what would be your choice?
Well, the answer is no, but what my choice would be, Down Down.
It's an absolute banger, isn't it? Coming back to the music, I wanted to talk about, again, I am a total layman here. I'm not well-versed on Cretan culture, but I do know someone who lives in Greece, and she said that she saw you guys play and that you were talking about poetry by Vincentos Kouranos. Is that correct? A poem called Erotokritos. Tell me about what that is and how that's been influencing some of your work.
Erotokritos is a love poem, epic poem, very long, 10,000 couplets by Vincenzo Cornaro back in 14th century in Crete. And that book has all the dialect of Crete language, and it's like a poetic Bible for Cretans. And it has been the expression of the local people from village to village, and back in days the people had it in their bags as they had a piece of bread and some olives and the book, go to the mountains, look after the sheep. And that was, each one had their own way to read and expression the stories the book has. So it's a big amount of the Crete culture in there, because the language and the way he puts the words.
Sort of like an essential sort of text that everyone in Crete is aware of and will have an understanding of.
Yes, the smallest kid to the oldest people.
And I wanted to come back a little bit to talk more broadly about the Sisyphean thing, because I know that you were saying, look, it's just something that it's a mindset that people have to engage in every day, and it's not this huge mythological thing every day. But I wanted to talk just generally very quickly about Greek myths in general. Maybe Georgios, why do you think that the Greek myths translate so universally around the world? Whereas, say, British sort of similar things, British folk culture, these strange traditions from the UK, even UK people don't know them. Why do you think that Greek myths are so universal and well-liked and remembered by everyone around the world?
I guess because each myth has a connection with other myths and takes on and on. It's a whole world of myths. Maybe that's what is attractive also. Has to do with gods and the other world and love and jealous, and which is human beings' relations.
Do you think they're maybe just bigger, more crazy, like everything is turned up to 11 in a Greek myth, you know? Would you agree with that, Jim?
I grew up reading those myths as a child, but I also read the, you know, Mesopotamian ones and the different ones and the English ones. I refer to some of the English ones in my mind in conversation. King Arthur or something, you know. But yeah, I have no idea. I'm not a historian like that. I mean, they won the publicity. They had a good publicist, right? Didn't the Romans like do their publicity for him or something?
I think they did, yeah. And the Cretan lute, it's not a very common instrument. I wonder, when you're touring with an instrument like that, I mean, if something goes wrong with that, is it easy to fix? Because if you're playing a guitar, you break a string, you just go to the nearest music shop and you get a new one put on. When you're handling an instrument like that, do problems with the instrument become real challenges on, say, gig day if something goes wrong?
Well, it depends. At the moment, these days, I was looking to find a particular string, which I don't have a spare one. Probably I have some, but it's not the right one. I thought it was, but it isn't. These days, I'm looking to find the right string. In London, I went in a few shops, but I couldn't find it. I've got a different one at the moment, from acoustic guitar. I guess that will make it for tonight.
So you have to just make do and mend.
Yeah, I have to play in a way, you know, I have to make my bread.
But also there's almost never been a show we've played where there wasn't a Cretan at the show. So, I mean, it's not an uncommon instrument in Crete or amongst Cretans. So if it comes down to it, you probably find a lute in every town, right, if you need to.
Yeah, that's true.
They know him, you know.
That was Clarice White talking to Tom Hall of Monocle, and the Sisypheans is out now, and you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. Dora Maar was a photographer, painter, surrealist, a muse of and collaborator with Picasso. She was pretty mighty as an experimental artist in her own right, mixing reportage with the avant-garde in photography, figuration in cubism and oils, and making some delightfully strange work for commercial clients in Paris in the 1930s too. Maar was photographed by Brassai, Beaton, Irving Penn and Lee Miller as a contemporary and co-conspirator in the art movements that shook the 20th century.
But the P word hangs over the reputation of Dora Maar like the cloud around a spooky castle. Just how do you deal with a problem like Pablo? Picasso painted 60 portraits of Maar during their long relationship, and they worked together on ideas for the artist's crowning glory, Guernica. To shed a lot of light on Dora Maar and a little on the continuing saga of Picasso, Rob went to the Tate Modern to meet the show's curator, Emma Lewis.
My name's Emma Lewis. I am the co-curator of the Tate Modern presentation of Dora Maar.
And it's a fascinating show. Thanks for walking us around. I wondered to begin with whether you started with the reputation of Dora Maar or whether you had specific images in mind.
A little bit of both. First of all, we wanted to show the real breadth of her output, but we knew that she is known largely for her surrealist photographs and her photo montages. Equally, it would be disingenuous of me to say that we weren't thinking about Picasso right from the beginning, because the challenge with a show like this is whether we acknowledge her relationship and their work together as artists, or whether we kind of downplay or even gloss over that period in her life. What we decided to do, and what I particularly wanted to do here at Tate, was to address that moment head on and use it as an opportunity to look very, very closely and very specifically at the ways in which they work together and influence one another.
Well, let's dive straight into that, as you mentioned it at the beginning, because it's a bit of a when is a sitter, not a sitter. She was very keen to say in interviews that she never modelled for Picasso. So she was a collaborator, and through Guernica and various key moments of his career, she was there influencing him. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So that kind of mutual influence plays out in a number of different ways. One is the cliché vert they produced together in 36, 37. That's a very complex darkroom technique combining printmaking and photography. Picasso had harboured an interest in that for some time, and although he was perfectly confident with taking photographs and liked to do that, he wasn't so accomplished or even really interested in the darkroom until this point. And in the time of his relationship with Maar, there was an opportunity for him to learn this technique, and so she worked with him to create these remarkable, very complex and interesting prints. But at the same time, he's encouraging her to go back to painting, which is something that she had studied, she'd harboured ambitions towards since she was a girl. And so there's an exchange there. Equally, this time, although Maar is concentrating on painting by the end of the 1930s, she's also photographing extensively for Picasso. She is documenting his complete archive. He was very aware that he would have a catalogue raisonné made at some point. And she's also commissioned to document the progression of Guernica. And this is really remarkable for a number of reasons. First of all, it's believed to be the first complete photographic record of a work in progress. And second of all, it's very technically accomplished of Maar, because the studio was challenging to shoot in. It had low lighting, low ceilings, and the canvas was absolutely enormous. And it's really only through this project that we can understand how Guernica developed.
And to go back to kind of Dora solo, it's an interesting time in the 1930s when publications were becoming so popular, fashion photography, commercial and editorial. She shot campaigns for Ombre Solaire, brands that people be familiar with. This seemed to actually help her happy accidents and experiments. Is that fair to say? I mean, there was quite of a broad canvas and some money sloshing around to do this work.
Absolutely. I mean, the beginning of the 1930s, she establishes a studio with a set designer, Pierre Keffer, and they make extraordinary photographs together. And indeed, she continues in that vein when their collaboration comes to an end in the mid-1930s. At this time, commercial photography is one of the most important forums in which artists can really push the boundaries of the medium. And there's a real appetite for experimental avant-garde images. And her commissions of people like Ombre Solaire, Petrol Hahn, the fabulously titled anti-aging cream called The Years Line Wait For You. These are all really great examples of her response to commissions. She kind of pushed the medium as far as it could go.
And just actually in terms of that kind of forum for photography, it kind of seems similar to now, that there are fewer sort of delineations between fine art and commercial, editorial and erotic as well, which is also part of her work.
Exactly, yeah.
That's something you kind of draw attention to. A lot of her work looks great in the magazines in which it originally appeared, and you display it at the similar size. Was that on purpose?
Yeah, it was absolutely intentional that we wanted to show the photographs, the final prints. But as anyone who's kind of has a cursory interest in photography knows that there's so much about process. So we've shown the negatives from which the works were made. You can really see Duramar's technique that way. And importantly, we're also showing the ways in which her work circulated. So the kind of magazines that were read by women, erotic reviews, but also quite specific trade journals as well.
And some of the work that is commercial is very experimental, which is strange. You wouldn't get the images you get that she was producing in the 30s to advertise beauty products or even editorialize beauty products now. Looking at some of the media of that decade, what conclusions do you draw from the kind of the elasticity of what it is to be an artist and a commercial artist?
One of the things that we have been looking at is this specific moment in the interwar period where there is a real boom in the illustrated press. I mean, for example, one of the magazines that Mara's shooting for, its circulation increases tenfold. This is a women's magazine. The idea of a woman as consumer is really being developed at this point. At the same time, women are occupying a very complex, contradictory roles between this like liberated, independent woman at the same time as being really encouraged post-war to go back into the domestic sphere. And in magazines, this idea of the modern woman is something that really takes hold. And we think that in some of Mara's works, at least, she is alluding to these contradictions. The inherent artifice of what she's helping to promote is something that there's at least kind of a knowing wink to, if you like.
And some of the sort of very pointedly surreal work that you show in a couple of the rooms in the sort of early mid-career of Duramar. What was the sort of critical reaction to that? You said in your talk that photography was always a thing of reportage, of telling the truth, or most often it was, and painting was where surrealism went. What was the critical reaction to her surreal photography?
Well, amongst the surrealists, at least, she was seen as somebody whose work embodied what surrealist photography could be, which is that it was placing images out of context or it was combining them in very unexpected ways. She wasn't the first to do this. Someone like Max Ernst and his collage was incredibly influential in these ideas in the 20s, as was somebody like Man Ray. You know, the surrealist movement really launched in 1924 and Duramar becomes associated with the circle in 33. But the major surrealist exhibitions don't happen until the 30s. And it's really significant that there's very few photographers included and Mara is one of them.
And to take it up to date, we're sitting in one of the last rooms here doing this interview. The penultimate room concerns her move back to painting. Mm-hmm. This was especially after her split from Picasso. He bought her a house in the south of France. And that's a very subdued room, subdued colours, subdued brush strokes and all the rest of it. We always try and read biography into this stuff, but it just looks like heartbreak. Mm. I know that you've shied very much away from that in your curatorial notes, but what's your read on these last two rooms?
I will say there is a canvas in that penultimate room that feels so poignant. It's a very poignant self-portrait, made in 45, and that's the period where her relationship with Picasso is really about to come to a final end after disintegrating for many years. But it's not only that, it's also that her mother dies very suddenly and they were close. Her best friend dies very suddenly. Other close friends have to go into exile. Her father leaves France for Argentina. And it's the end of the Second World War and things are really changing. So this is a very difficult period for her, understandably. And the self-portrait, I think, embodies that. The other works in this room are made up until the 70s, and I think there are definitely still lives that feel kind of claustrophobic and perhaps reflect the atmosphere of Paris during the occupation. But the works, I would say, in the south of France are a little bit more looser, and perhaps there's an optimism there. The palette becomes a bit brighter. There's a kind of freeing up. And perhaps she found some clarity and freedom escaping the city centre, as I think we can probably all relate to.
And just finally, we're sitting in front of a huge screen of her doctored negatives. And I think the headline in this last room is cameraless photography. It's certainly one of the themes of it. This is still seen as a pretty avant-garde thing. Where was Duramar on this sort of sliding scale of being a kind of progenitor of this form? As you said, she was bored of walking out of her apartment in Paris and looking at the street, which she described as banal.
Yes. So what we wanted to do in this room is to show, first of all, the parallels with what she was doing in the 1980s and the 1930s. So she's treating negatives in much the same way. She's engraving into them. She's using chemicals, water to corrode and manipulate the surface. And it just shows how that interest in innovation, manipulation, construction was something that stayed with her for all of her career.
And that was Rob speaking to Emma Lewis at the Duramar Show at Tate Modern, which runs until the 15th of March next year. You're with the Monocle Weekly.
Oh, well, there we have it, Org. Another fine mess you got me into, as Laurel says to Hardy.
Was it a hot mess or a cold mess?
I think it was lukewarm.
A tepid mess.
No, it was good.
Thanks for joining me.
I thoroughly enjoyed that. And kudos to you for getting so many difficult to say people into the mix this week.
Yeah, you should see next week.
Yeah? Yeah. What have we got?
I can't say.
Okay.
I literally can't say.
I literally can't say.
That was great, Rob. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for joining me.
It's good stuff. I would recommend getting yourself down to the Dora Maar show at Tate Modern.
It's I will.
It's an extensive exhibition. I think it is an interesting thing that a lot of reviews of that exhibition have tackled. And obviously Emma herself in that interview talked about is what do you do when a great artist has gone out with the greatest art of the 20th century, and they're a woman, and how do you reconstruct that? There's a lot of architecture of heaviness about that kind of thing.
At the risk of sounding a little bit smug and on the nose, I, for one, welcome the revisionist retake of 20th century art. I think it's exciting. You have Lee Krasner getting more traction. Yeah. You have Dora Maar, obviously, and it's good to reflect on the narratives of history and to think, actually, we can rewrite these.
You will be familiar with the broadcaster Andrew Maar. Mm-hmm. He does the politics show and various other things on the BBC. I saw Andrew Maar walking around the Dora Maar show and said, do you only come to shows with the same surname as you?
What did
he
say?
And he just went, no.
Brilliant.
So that went down. From one heavyweight broadcaster to another, that went down like a lead balloon.
I'm glad I did that.
Well, I'm glad I'm sharing it with the Monocle Weekly.
A good place to leave it, I think.
That's all for
edition 542 of The Monocle Weekly. What else could this have been?
Yeah.
I produced today's show. Our studio managers were Maylie Evans and Jack Jewers.
And The Monocle Weekly will, of course, be back same time, same place next week, probably with the same personnel. So for the time being, for me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Augusta Magellari.
Thank you very much for tuning in.